Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Greetings and welcome to this episode of Edgy Ideas with our special guest, Lynn Sedgemore. Lynn's going to share her journey of women's leadership. She began life in a working class mining community and went on to have an influence on national education as a chief executive and working at prime ministerial level with Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. Lynn's received many awards and was given a CBE in 2002. Lynn, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Delighted to be here, Simon. Thank you.
Good. So we got a lot to talk about. So let's start with your journey. So you were born into a coal mining village in the north of England, is that right? Or Midlands?
In the Midlands, in Staffordshire, Stoke-on-Trent, Newcastle-under-Lyme. So yes, my father was a Welsh miner who migrated to the Midlands in 1950 for work. And I was born in 1955, and we lived on a council estate, a mining estate, with people from all over the country, actually, who had come there for work as miners.
And how did you find your way into further education in that career? Tell us about that, how your journey.
I fell into it, to be honest. I didn't know anything about further education, although my sister had trained as a medical secretary in FE. I discovered it because I took a lodger from an FE college and then wanted to find out what it was. And I was a yacht supervisor in the 80s in Stoke, having done my degree in English literature and trained as an English and history teacher, and then found out that there was something called the Youth Opportunity Training Scheme and YTS, and went into further education as a lecturer in social and life skills, the lowest of the low, the bottom of the rung, and loved it. Fell in love with further education from the day I went there. It was erratic, it was disorganised, it was kind of really, you'd say, please don't get me teaching maths, I'm not numerate. And then you'd have a 3-hour session of maths with the towpath lads who didn't want to be there. And I felt I had come home. I absolutely loved it. Yeah.
Good, good. And what was it like being a woman leader? You're interested in feminism and you've had a long kind of political interest and engagement. Tell us about being a woman leader going on that journey on the rise through FE.
Yeah, it was quite interesting for me because I didn't get a full-time job until I was 26. Mm-hmm. And I was a feminist activist, very active in Stoke and then in London, and very much a part of writing collectives and lots of protests. I was a second wave feminist. And I decided to go and work full-time in FE when I moved to London. And began to gradually shift from my feminist activist into full-time FE work because I loved it. What I found in those days, there was huge sexism. Men were literally smacking you on the bottom, treating you as the little lady, doing things today that would be totally inappropriate, and Me Too would be really dealing with them. As a working class kid on a estate, I've always had to learn how to navigate different worlds. I was a bright kid, top of my class in the primary school, which I still visit every year, by the way, and bright in the grammar school. I'm a grammar school kid. So I learned very early on to navigate different worlds, my world, middle class world, education world. So by the time I'd gone into FE, I was pretty savvy about what the system game was and how women were seen to have to prove themselves. And I played the game. I never sold my soul. I was quite clear what I would do and wouldn't do. And I was good at what I did. I loved it. I loved it. So I kept getting promoted. But I got promoted on merit.
Yeah, because I worked in FE later on. We met and I was doing some work in FE. And it was still a fairly kind of macho culture. There's just a lot of, kind of patriarchy in there, isn't there?
I tell you how, one of the ways that I was successful, people used to say to me, Lynn, you take the jobs that no one else wants and you make a success of them. Mm-hmm. So why I got promoted so quickly, I was good at what I did, but it was all through things like the manpower services, women into management. It was the new things that were on the edge of further education that I was, as a feminist activist, as someone who'd done life and social skills, was really equipped to do. So I took them on with gusto. And then what gradually happened was, hey, this woman can do anything. This woman will sort it out. And then I eventually, it wasn't until I was 30 that I got a permanent contract in a senior, more traditional role in FE. There's a whole group of us in the early 80s who came into FE through the unemployment route, the YTS route, on the fringes of FE, who then had so many skills that was wanted that we became senior mainstream leaders. So that was my route, and you'll find lots of women who came in through that route at that time.
And I'm quite interested. I mean, me and you know each other a long time. You know, I've been your coach, we've become friends. It's I'm interested in essentializing women's leadership, and I'm a bit troubled by it because you get this line at business school saying, you know, women more caring, more compassionate, and then they essentialize a kind of caring, nurturing kind of woman, which is a great communicator. And some of the best women leaders I've seen aren't exactly like that. They're much, you know, tell us.
I'm writing a paper on that at the moment. I'm in the middle of it. I'm absolutely clear that essentialism restricts.
Yeah, yeah.
Some women are nurturing and kind. I'm nurturing and kind, and I'm as tough as old boots. I had to be, yeah?
Yes.
I've been called aggressive, demanding, impossible. And in many ways, I exhibit so-called masculine traits.
Yeah.
My internal landscape is actually androgynous, so I can draw on male and female, which I don't actually believe in. I think I totally believe gender is a social construct, and so we actually look at those through a lens that is a binary lens that's not helpful. So all in all my leadership development and my own journey as a leader, I'm really clear. The best is that whether you're male or female, you can find out who you are, what your authentic self is, what your talents are, what your weaknesses are, what needs developing, and you manifest yourself to your fullest capability as a really good leader.
Yeah.
And it can be any shape or form, any shape or form. So, yeah I am totally in that space.
Yeah, I mean, that's my experience. And I think these limits put on men and women, like either to be aggressive or to be caring or whatever, are really destructive. And we all have different aspects, and we're all kind of bring our different experiences. And it's kind of being your best and bringing out your own unique potential.
Yes.
Is important.
Yes. And I'm totally with that. And why I think feminist leadership is important. And I've developed my own leadership program that has feminism running and integrated all the way through, is what feminism does that's different than just masculine and female qualities. And there's a value in those. There's a value in us expanding our repertoire. I'm not dismissing them. It doesn't go far enough for me. But what feminism does is it looks at the systemic oppression. It looks at the way power is developed within a patriarchal society, which actually is looking through a lens of where men are seen to be superior just by the fact that they were born male. So yeah. I'm also interested in the deconstruction and the looking at the way leaders can actually look at a more systematic organizational and national and whatever sphere they work in, way in which you can have organizations and communities that are not oppressing people and really look at what is this power we have? What shape and form does it take? And how can it genuinely be shared? And it goes beyond just talking about distributed leadership. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. And yeah, separating that kind of systemic influence and power influences, which are like institutional racism, institutional sexism,
exactly.
Really important, as opposed to kind of putting people in little boxes and saying men are like this and women like that. It's a different ball game, isn't it?
Yeah, What one of the hardest things I did as the chief exec of the Centre of Excellence was say publicly, yes, every college is institutionally racist. Mm. Yeah. Their sector went bananas, mostly, not obviously not people of colour. It was on the front page of the Times, Ed. Lynn Sedgemoore has said this, and yeah. I stood by it. It's like, and that debate just keeps raging, isn't it? We're not accusing an individual of being racist, yes. although they might be. We are talking about an institutional process that disadvantages people of colour and women. In that case, we were looking at racism. I've never shied away from that. You know, I came from a really loving but fierce working class family. You spoke your truth, you had a row, you battled it out verbally, and then you never went to sleep on it. You made up, you talked about it, and you moved on. So I'm used to facing, and I have a personality that finds that easy. I enjoy challenges and confrontations and moving through difficult, fierce conversations to harmony and cooperation.
Yeah, yeah. And when I first met you, I met you when you'd just been promoted to chief executive of this national body, and that was a big shift for you, wasn't it? Tell me about moving into the national.
Right. I can feel the visceral. It was fairly easy for me. I'm not saying it was easy, but it was easy for me to go up through the ranks, if you like, in an FE college. It was a territory I knew well for 20 years. Ups and downs, but I knew. Moving into a national role, well, it brought me to my knees, and you were a key part of supporting that. And actually, several other men were. Some of the men that I knew who'd gone through it helped me too, and women. It was making that shift from, even though I'd been nurturing and collective, and you know, all my metaphors were about I was kind of nurturing and caring, it was moving to a networked national way of leading that, you know, as we worked together, which was invaluable for me, it was really moving into this eco-leadership, this approach. I remember drawing a Petri dish with all the different bits in that had to come together. I mean, that was a visceral moment for me when I realized I have to do something different here to succeed. Plus, I was working with civil servants and I never learned to speak Mandarin. I never will, where everything was very fudgy and not clear and direct, and everybody worried about who they were going to upset or what a minister would say. So I found that world very, very difficult to navigate. I learned and I did it well, but it was traumatic, to be honest, making that transition.
Yeah, and I recall working with you through that period. It was huge, but I mean, a very impressive shift as well, because I remember drawing those pictures of you being a dynamo in the middle of a college, being the principal with all the energy, and then realizing that you had to become an influencer and a connector and work in networks. And it's a very different ballgame. And you managed to do that shift. It was very interesting to work with you during those years. The other thing I remember was first meeting you, we were sat around a campfire. We had one of your annual meetings, you got everybody around a campfire, and I started talking to you, and we realized that we shared spirituality in common. And you told me your promiscuous story of all the different kind of religions and spiritualities you'd been part of and engaged with. And do you want to talk a bit about kind of your spirituality and where that takes you now in leadership roles?
Yes, I've always had a desire to know who God was, and meaning of life. My parents were agnostics, but they sent me to Sunday school. So I've always had this unquenchable interest in how other people and faith traditions offer meaning in the world. So I'm an ordained interfaith minister. I've studied nearly all the religions. I was a practicing Buddhist for 12 years. And now I'm exploring goddess spirituality and feminist versions of spirituality. And as always, I'm enjoying it thoroughly. It's I am a sort of theologian in a way, because I've read so much, but I've never wanted to do it full time. It's my service has always been education, because education helps me to move out of my working class situation. I'm very proud of being working class. But at the same time, I didn't want the life that of the people I saw around me. I wanted something different. So spirituality, religion, but particularly spirituality has always nurtured me. I'm a mystic. I feel a strong connection with something bigger than myself, which is beyond gender for me in many ways. The reason I'm working with goddess spirituality is because I think in a patriarchal society, actually having an acceptance and an experimentation with the divine as female is a disruptive act. And that's why I'm doing it. And I'm loving it because there is something absolutely beautiful and glorious in the celebration and the liberation of women experiencing themselves as fully sacred and images of women in sacredness. So it's great. I love it.
That's interesting you make the connection between the feminism and the goddess, because a lot of the goddess, I think a lot of people project onto that goddess movement, I don't know if it's true or not, is the Mother Earthy kind of a withdrawal from the political, let's say.
Okay, huge debate took place in the 70s. For some women, spirituality was political and it's a feminist act. And for me, it is. For others, they're not. These are women who have been hurt by mainstream and have chosen to stay right outside. And it's not a political act. It's more of an eco act. But you get lots of goddess spirituality activists who were doing lots of work in Extinction Rebellion and in other places. So it's like any movement or any experience, you have a spectrum of people. But goddess spirituality really arose very much, the neo goddess spirituality, in the 70s out of feminist movements and feminist discourse.
And you live in the very heart of it down in Glastonbury in the West Country, close to where I was brought up.
I do. I've always come to Glastonbury. It's my spiritual home. I've been all over the world. I'm one of those people who belong everywhere. I'm an edge walker, but there's also a part of me that can fit in everywhere. I've settled in Glastonbury, just outside Glastonbury. And I love it here because of the diversity. It's very much indigenous spirituality in the sense of most of the spiritual traditions here are Druids, pagans, there's Christians, there's Sufis, there's all kinds. But it's an earth-based spirituality, shamanic-based spirituality, goddess spirituality, which I'm really enjoying. As somebody who's spent a lot of time in a head, I needed to find practices, spiritual practices, that earth and help me to embody more with the land. I'm just really loving it. Fantastic.
I think it's very interesting. I mean, I've traveled a long spiritual journey as well and in different ways. And I ended up being a Quaker. I'm still a member of the Quaker, the Religious Society of Friends. And now I attend the mainstream church in Ireland here, the Protestant Church. But it's always been these edgy groups, these groups on the edge. The Quakers were founded in the northwest of England and away from the centre, and they kind of experimented with spirituality and with politics and everything. And it's very needed, isn't it? These edgy communities to kind of create change.
Absolutely. And I love being on the edge. I love being part of something that's generating or introducing new things, new ways of seeing, new ways of looking. I worked for 4 years in the Quaker Centre, co-tutoring on Soul of Leadership, Margaret Benefield's programme. Quakers are absolutely wonderful and so open and inclusive. So yes, I've in leadership, my doctorate is on how I fostered and supported spirituality in further education. And several books have been written on my work because I wouldn't want to force a spiritual perspective on anyone, but I am very, very committed to co-creating communities in which people's wholeness can arise and be expressed, and they can bring their whole selves into the community or to the workplace. And for me, spirituality was part of that. But when I was a chief exec, it didn't have to be for you. You could bring whatever part of you you wanted to bring in. I have now, my book should be out in this autumn. I have developed the Goddess Luminary Wheel, which I think is a really edgy leadership development program that takes all my experience and wisdom over 36 years in FE and working in different organizations and studying leadership since I can remember, and using that through a spiritual, sacred feminine goddess lens. I've had 80 people so far come on the face-to-face programs or the online programs, and people are loving it. People who are drawn to it are loving them. We look at power, authenticity. It's a really fulsome leadership program.
And is that women only programs, or do you have you have men as well?
Back to our original thing. For me, men, people of all genders, can find something important in looking at goddess and the sacred feminine. So whoever, I have got men on the program, not in large numbers, but they've enjoyed it too. So anyone who is drawn to explore in themselves their sacred feminine or goddess as a divine portal, if you like, then welcome, and people of all genders as well.
It's made me think a lot. I've been talking to quite a lot of young men recently, and they're really struggling with masculinity, and some get very hurt, and they turn to become kind of misogynistic groups. They feel they can't find their voice. And I'm wondering what kind of movements there are in parallel for men who are, they don't fit into the patriarchy and they're tired of kind of what's going on, but I don't know. A lot of young men seem lost to me.
I think that's right. I don't particularly work with men, but there is a group in Glastonbury and all over the country called Journeymen. Mm-hmm. Journeymen.
Yeah.
And that's men working with young men for exactly the reason that you're saying. And they do some fantastic work. So in that sense, I think it's really important that men and women can support them, help young lads. So older men in the... You know, I offer my leadership programs to young women at a third of the cost that it would be. So it's that, how do we give back and support and enable? And I think there's an important role for men. And I've just run for a charity, a session on feminist leadership, and 30% were men. So we talked about men being feminists. We talked about what men can do. So I think the debate has travelled a long way from the second wave, when it was we women had to do it for ourselves. It's how, in terms of intersectionality and allyship and all those changes in third and fourth wave feminism, how can men be part of that, engage with that, and also work out for themselves? Because men are... Yes, they have more privilege within a patriarchy, but they're also harmed and damaged and limited in all sorts of ways. And I think it's wonderful that the discourse in feminism now includes men as much as it does women.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, patriarchy is hugely damaging to men, and particularly working class men, and you know, and men who don't get some of the same privileges as
exactly
other men. And it's I mean, you listened to my podcast with Lauren on queerness, and when I was in Berkeley, California, I studied queer theology, and it was just enlightening to me. And it really, we realized just how trapped we are in these mindsets. You know, it's always like never made real sense to me, this kind of binary difference, you know. But I think there's a huge potential in this non-binary space. I think where we're just not boxed in into these polarized opposites.
I totally agree, and that's an area I'm exploring, because for many people, their image of the divine is linked to an internal kind of sense of how they see it or feel it. If you can get beyond, you know, God is an old man with a beard in the sky kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I'm having really, I've actually developed a model. I might send it to you, Simon, looking at how people image the divine in different ways, including queer imagery. Because one of the things that, being where I am, which is an intersectional feminist, is the goddess spirituality doesn't need to just limit. I think you have to say you can have an expansiveness within it, but the act of talking about and working with the divine as female is a disruptive act. It still is in this society we're in. And it not becoming an essentialist limitation that falls into. And I did a lot of research on sacred feminine leadership, and most of them are bringing the sweetness and the softness and the caring. My leadership program, that's in there. Emotional intelligence is in there. The love is at the heart of it, but it's a much more, all the terms that I use are gender free.
I look forward to reading that. I'm reading a couple of people at the moment which are interesting. Donna Haraway and Anita Singh. She wrote Mushroom at the End of the World, and these are again, feminists who are scientists at the same time, and they're really helping me. You know, I've been talking about eco leadership for a decade now or more. It's kind of I'm into this idea of ecosystems, but even though I'm into it, we're still trapped by the same mindsets we've kind of grown up with. Yeah. We still got to kind of wrestle with ourselves every day.
Yeah.
And they're really teaching me about kind of relationality and making with and companionship with other beings, with other critters, with other, with plants, with animals, and just the kind of key point is that, you cannot ever make anything separate from anything else. Yeah. It's always making with, whether if you're digesting food, the bacteria in your gut is helping you. If you're, fungus helps trees kind of grow and mature.
Yeah.
And they're really doing this from a scientific perspective, from a feminist perspective, from a social change perspective, from an environmental perspective. And I think it's really exciting.
I totally agree. And I've just attended a workshop with Kappler Horizons on how the brain is an energy system and all interconnected. And as I was listening to the excellent presenter, I'm saying to him, that's how mystics see the world. You're coming at this through a scientific, but actually, that's how I see the world. For religion is about belief, but mystics are about gnosis. And the gnosis is about that interconnectedness, that non-separation, that non-dual, if you like, and that's something else that I love working with and playing with. Flow, synchronicity, the way in which in leadership, if you can really lead from the emerging future. Otto Sharma's work, a whole Lalou's work. There's a whole literature on leadership, which I really went into for my doctorate and have been teaching as well, of emergence and flow and interconnectivity. Yeah, I think it's fabulous, Simon. It's a great time. I know there's like all sorts of things going on about climate crisis, et cetera, but it's also a great time to be alive for somebody my age, because something that I've known for a long time about interconnectedness is being articulated in ways that before it was seen as a bit wacky or cranky or quite not right. And for me, it's a mystical perspective on the world. Others see it through other lenses.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I've been trying to get my head around quantum physics a bit, but I just read something about quantum entanglements and it's the same thing, really. It's the same. These old mystics, these pre-modern ideas, these Hindu understandings of the world, these kind of interconnected, that's what quantum is about. He calls it quantum entanglements. It's like everything is relational. It's not like kind of if you're an observer, you something changes when you observe it. It's that you have a relationship with it, and it's that relationship which always changes. And it's very, it all kind of comes back on itself. It's a fascinating time we're in, I think. Fascinating.
In 1992, I think it was, I went, IBM invited me to a conference because I was doing some work with IBM, and the Dalai Lama was there and Paul Davis was there. And what they did, this is 1992, was they had spiritual speakers, Dalai Lama was the one I remember most, and scientists talking about time and talking about biology and talking about different things. And it was saying that then it had such a profound effect on me. And I think that was right on the edges of discourse, because there was a time when IBM were doing awesome things. They were using the I Ching in there. And now this is becoming much more mainstream discourse, the re-enchantment of the world and all of those things. And I'm in my elements with it. It's like linking it to leadership and the Goddess Luminary Wheel approach is my way of linking all of that together in my expression of how to support people who want to travel that journey with me. Yeah.
Well, it's fabulous to see you flourishing and then sharing your knowledge and your wisdom. Lynn, I ask all guests at the end of these sessions two questions about what they can help us with to think about how we live a good life and how to create the good society. And I just wonder what your thoughts are.
Well, I love the term right livelihood, the Buddhists. I discovered that in the 80s and realized that further education for me was right livelihood. There were other people saying, I hate my job, I don't want to do this. And I'm like, oh, I never heard of that. Oh, I love ethic. Oh, I think that is right livelihood. It's like, oh, I feel so blessed. So my advice would be, follow your heart and your passion, what really makes your soul sing, if you can. And I know it's tougher these days, that you're actually doing love in action, I would call it. It's your version of right livelihood. And I think most of us want to be good, whatever that means to us. But, you know, you think about how do you want to offer something and be of service in the world. And I think, in a bigger sense, for me, it's what is that service that adds something more to the world that actually makes it a better place. Now, for me, it was FE, further education, transforming young people and adults' lives. Now I'm an elder. I'm supporting young women. I'm supporting people who couldn't afford to do leadership development, who want to, by offering it at really, really low cost. Mm-hmm. And offering the wisdom that I have to enable others to access it, then they go on to make a difference in the world. So I think I'm as much kind of supporting the younger activists and people who will change the world in their way, because I've been out there on the front line. I've been there in the spotlight. Don't want that anymore. I want to be, if you like, power with, power for, power through, and supporting other people to make the world and society a good place. Because I think we all want it deep down. I think it's only people who are wounded that don't, and they can't.
Yeah. That's brilliant. Lynn Sedgemoor, thank you very much for being a guest on Edgy Ideas. I'm sure the audience will love this. Keep shining.
Well, thanks, Simon, and keep up the good work. I think it's fantastic what you're doing. It's wonderful. And thanks for everything you've done in my life too. Take care. Bye, everyone. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like further information about our coach and leadership training, or would like to join our advanced community of practice where we discuss edgy ideas and much, much more, please contact me, Simon@analyticnetwork.com.